say, who are disabled or those who are unhoused, even, or any vulnerable group, or those who feel like, oh, I'm such a burden to my family. I just want to have some aid in dying, and I want to get out of here and not burden them further. So what about coercion when people are getting coerced to choose a death like that?
Mm-hmm. Let's start with the disability rights community, which, you know, I have so much respect for that community, but we're kind of at loggerheads on this issue. I think for reasons that are fairly said are due to the stigma against disabilities. Somebody who's severely disabled might have an episode of pneumonia and they go to the hospital, and we hear about this all the time. And they are told, well, you don't want to be on a ventilator. We should just be able to end your life. I have such sadness about that. And it shouldn't happen, and we are doing everything we can to not have it happen. In my community, the Aid in Dying community, I and my colleagues work as hard as we can to be absolutely sure that our patients have terminal illnesses, not disabilities. Here's a great comparison. Somebody with ALS is severely disabled along the course of their illness. They get weaker and weaker and weaker. They eventually are in wheelchairs, which is fine. It's a method of transport. Then they're in beds, and then they're having a hard time breathing, and they frequently suffocate and die. Until that person has truly less than 6 months to live, by very fair certainty, we have experience with these illnesses, we do not help them die. We do not make them eligible for medical aid in dying. We help them with their illness. We get them palliative care. But until they are actually dying, so the person with a severe disability who says that my value, people don't value my life, my heart goes out to them. I also will not help them die. And to the data that we have so far, that hasn't happened. So there hasn't been a single case of somebody with a disability who's not terminally ill, who we can see a good report on that validates it, was helped to die by medical aid in dying. So the concept of vulnerable populations is not new to us. In writing these laws, it was very careful. That's why you need two doctors. That's why you need to have two requests from most states, you need two requests from patients separated by an amount of time called the waiting period. It's not taken lightly. We are required to look into coercion. So if a family is saying, gee, I wish mom would die so I could have the house, we have to take mom aside and say, anybody in your family who's trying to encourage you to do this because of your suspicion of, you know, it might be coercion. Now, that doesn't mean that there is no coercion ever, right? In disease, if somebody wants to stop chemotherapy, right? They might have somebody in their family who said, mom, you're suffering too much. Don't do that. Or they might be coerced into starting chemotherapy when they really don't want it. Coercion is an element. Family interaction is an element that's real. We can't make that go away. When does it cross the line into coercion? Well, I think that's a question for the elder abuse specialists. And I haven't seen much elder abuse about this topic, except for patients who are being forced not to. I have had patients who were dying who tried to get in touch with me, and the family disconnected their phone, and we had no way to find them. That's elder abuse. If the patient wants to talk to a doctor about their death, and the family doesn't approve, and they cut off their phone service, that's elder abuse. So we see coercion in very many ways. I don't think that coercion is a significant problem in my part of medicine any more than most parts of medicine. Family interactions and coercion exist in all aspects of life. I don't think it's any different for us. We try our hardest to not have it be a strong factor. We call in elder abuse if necessary. I think for the disability rights community, they have very strong feelings about this, and I respect them, those feelings, and I respect the population. I think for the coercion question, it just hasn't proven to be a problem. Now in 27 years of aid in dying care in the United States, we haven't seen coercion emerge as a difficult problem, and we've been looking for it.
Well, thanks for that clarification. I'm wondering who would be considered professionals in end-of-life care? Who are some of the professionals?
We jokingly say that end-of-life care is a team sport. It is. We have certainly for medical aid in dying, the physician, or in some states, physician assistants or nurse practitioners are kind of in charge of the prescription, the evaluation, the prognosis, judging the patient's capacity for decision making. All that falls into the realm of the physician. The rest of care, including hospice care, is social workers, chaplains, therapists, musicologists, death doulas, and death doulas who are trained in aid and dying care. So there are end-of-life doulas, and there are end-of-life doulas who are also trained in aid and dying care. We train them. You name it, nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, everybody gets involved in a good end-of-life care. Does that always happen? Well, sometimes patients don't elect for hospice. But in the best of circumstance, end-of-life care is a team sport.
I love hearing that. And when you mentioned something about getting a request, putting out a request for something, you said it needs to have two physicians. There needs to be a period of time between permission from the two. I'm just confused about that. And I'm confused also about a verbal request and a written request.
You are not the first person to be confused by laws, especially these laws. And it's especially confusing for patients who are ill at the end of their life. Patients who are ill struggle with energy and other issues. So, to put it as simply as possible, I'll pretend we're in California. A lot of the laws are similar, but there are unique laws in different states that are variations. Here in California, if you, for instance, find out the nominate and dying clinician, and you contact me, and we have the first appointment. The first thing you say is, I'm thinking about medical aid in dying. Well, that's a verbal request. You just have to tell me, and you don't have to say, I would like to invoke my rights under the End of Life Option Act of California of 2016. You just have to say, I'm thinking about medical aid in dying. Tell me more. That's a request. It's not a finished product. A lot of people say that until you make a decision about your date, it's not really a request. No, a first verbal request means a request. You're thinking about it. Then 48 hours go by and you can make a second verbal request. And you also have to sign a written request form with two witnesses. Again, we take this seriously. And then you become, if you have a prognosis of less than 6 months to live, according to me, let's say, as the doctor, and I feel like you had mental capacity for decision making, that you weren't confused or disoriented, and I've done an evaluation to minimize the possibility of coercion, well, then you are eligible for aid in dying. That means that at some point in time, then or in the future, some patients want it right away. That's pretty rare. Some patients wait 6 months. That's pretty rare. Most of the time, we just go down the path from there and watch how they're dying. As I said, everybody has their independent way of dying. And we kind of hang out with them and we talk about it. And if they go down the path and they are having a reasonably good death and they don't need me, then I'm fine and happy about that. And if they do want me to be around for aid in dying, I'm also fine and okay with that. But the eligibility phase is that rough thing that I just described, two verbal requests, one written request with witnesses, and then a short waiting period in California, 48 hours. Different states, I think New Jersey still has 15 days. Many of the states like Oregon have a short waiting period, but also the right to waive the waiting period in case the patient is seriously ill and heading towards their death immediately and wants help. So we can waive the period. It's quite variable from state to state, but that's the general gist of it. Some of these safeguards are good to make sure that patients aren't willy-nilly just entering into hastening of their death. Some of the safeguards are just obstacles and they get in the way. So you have to kind of look at this and say, what's the balance? I think safeguards are necessary. California used to have a 14-day waiting period. It's been shortened to 48 hours because 14 days, people were dying while waiting. When they wanted medical aid in dying and they were just dying because they couldn't get it because they were stuck in that waiting period, that turned out to be an undue burden rather than a safeguard. So we went back to the legislature and they changed it and they made a proposition and it's now 48 hours. So it's an evolving pattern, but the short answer to your question is it varies from state to state and you have to follow the law.
And in the laws, they're being changed all the time or edited in some way.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
We
exactly.
learn as we go. You know, it started with what's called the Oregon model, as you said, around 1997. And it started with the Oregon model, and then it was followed as the Oregon model, and then it got modified here and modified there and modified here and modified there. And each state has come up with their own laws. We gain with experience. Here's the point. The Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine is 6 years old. Medical aid in dying has existed for 27 years. We are now watching really carefully and figuring out what works. What doesn't work? What works for the medications? What works for waiting periods? What works for who writes the prescriptions? What works for rural populations? What works for urban populations? We are making this into a science, a part of end-of-life care, data-driven, best practices, standards of care, promulgated by the academy. We teach a lot, we teach people, and then legislators and others look at it and modify laws. But aid in dying has wonderfully changed over the years. That's the whole point.
As you're saying that, I'm thinking aid in dying is not a routine thing. There's nothing routine about it.
So aid in dying is rarely used. Data shows roughly, I'm going to give you the average, about 0.1% of people of all deaths are aid in dying deaths. It varies from community to community. It varies from disease to disease. ALS, for instance, has the highest rate of aid in dying for any disease, including cancer. And that's because it's a rare disease, but it's more commonly used. So it's still rare. And I think that's a good thing. The question I think that we have to look at is aid in dying rare because most people don't know about it or can't access it? Or is it rare because it's rarely needed? And we don't know the answer to that question yet. Until there's more information out there, until there are good programs like yours that make people aware of what the possibilities are and give them a better understanding, it may be that with more awareness, understanding, that the rate of aid in dying increases. I don't think it will be ever that common. It's something that with good palliative care, with good end-of-life care, can be decreased in frequency, but not because we feel it's a failure of those things. You know, one thing to really be important about is when somebody does medical aid in dying, takes medications to die, that's not because other treatments failed. It's because that was the patient's choice. Some patients could have the best treatment in the world, the wonderful palliative care, the most supportive families who want them to have a so-called natural death, and they still decide, look, I'm tired. In fact, I will tell you that the most common reason that patients finally take medications to die is fatigue. It's not pain. We can control pain. It's not nausea. We can control nausea. It's often not because they're in bed and they don't like their diapers changed. In fact, they learn to love diapers when they get towards the end of life. It's fatigue. When somebody calls me and they say, Doc, I am so tired, I can't go on anymore, then I know that they're ready. And so this is rare. I think it will be more common, not only as more states come on as they're doing, but it will be more common as knowledge increases. Will it ever be common? I don't think so.
You mentioned ALS, and I'm wondering about when it progresses to such a point, somebody can't swallow the medication. And if that's the case, whether it's ALS or something else, because it's mandatory that the person actually take the medication themselves. Somebody outside cannot administer the medication, I believe, is the legality of it. And so, what are the alternatives if they're so progressed in their disease they can't swallow?
Great question. Thank you. From 1997 to 2016, the term self-administration, which is what you're talking about, the patient has to take the medications themselves, was interpreted to mean swallowing. We, as conscientious physicians and other clinicians, were confused because the term self-administration is not very clear. It may be, you know, it's just written in that law. What does that really involve? So we went to the California Medical Board and we asked them. And they said, as long as the patient has a physical action to self-administer the medications and it involves the gastrointestinal tract, that's self-administration. And I tell you, my eyes widened and I was thinking, wow. That's interesting. So for so many years, we thought it was only swallowing. They're telling us anything in the gastrointestinal tract. So now we have feeding tubes. We have patients who have colostomies. We can use that. And rectal administration. Enemas are pretty common in the world. Everybody knows how to do it. And we can do the medication administration that way as well. We can't. I'm sorry. Let me correct that. We can place the tube. The patient has to self-administer. So the patient has to be able to, if they can't swallow anymore, let's say they have esophageal cancer and their swallowing is obstructed. We can place a rectal catheter, fill a large syringe with the medications, and they push the plunger on the syringe, and they have administered the medications themselves into the gastrointestinal tract. So starting around 2016, as I said, medical care advances, and we have too. And so we have many methods through feeding tubes, through colostomies, through rectal tubes, and through helping people learn how to swallow, which we can help teach them. We have many ways of helping. There are cases where somebody completely loses physical ability. And that's what's frightening about ALS, is that at some point in time, they can't push a plunger. At some point in time, they can't swallow. And then they're at risk of suffocation, and they don't want that. And so we have to, sadly, talk with ALS patients about, look, if you're going to do medical aid in dying, you need to do it while you still have some hand strength. And it may be earlier than you want, but if you don't do it during that window, you can't do it later. And that's fine. You just need to know the rules here, right? So there is a question, I think, of for people who can't self-administer the medications, about whether we are being prejudiced against people with disabilities who don't have the ability to self-administer. And we had a lawsuit about that in California. We lost that. But that is going to evolve over time, especially in new states.
This is really good information to have, because it just shows how complex it all is, for sure. And I'm just wondering that if, in your experience, what would be, let's say someone is not terminally ill, they don't have the 6 months prognosis. So what are some of the alternatives for people who don't have that prognosis?
I'll be clear about it from a legal point of view. If you don't qualify for medical aid in dying in the jurisdictions where it is legal, as you said at the opening, about 22% of the population is covered. If you're in a non-aid in dying state, or you are in an aid in dying state and you don't have a terminal illness, if you decide to take your life, it's considered to be a suicide. And that's problematic in some circumstances. In some circumstances, it's a suicide and it should be treated as such and get suicide prevention out there. In other circumstances, it may be a patient, for example, the toughest ethical question we're dealing with is patients with dementia who will lose the ability to make the decision. Because when they reach a terminal illness, when somebody with dementia is so sick with their dementia that they are terminally ill, they have lost capacity to make decisions. And since they can't put this on a living will and decide in advance that they want medical aid in dying, and they can't make a decision once they enter that window of a less than 6 month prognosis, there is no way that we can work with dementia patients in general. There are some small exceptions, but in general. So there's a big movement to figure out how to work with dementia. Patients with dementia can legally stop eating and drinking while they still have decision-making capacity. Some do. It's difficult. I don't want to oversimplify what's called VSAD, voluntary stopping of eating and drinking. You need support. You need medical support commonly. Many patients embark on that and then turn away. It's too difficult. Many also can complete it. I'm not an expert on voluntary stopping of eating and drinking. It certainly exists, and there are people to talk to about that. And it's most commonly used for patients with dementia. For other illnesses, let's just say that you have a severe disability or a severe illness that is making you in chronic pain or something like that, but you are not terminally ill. The answer is, what I say to people, let's get you in touch with palliative care. Let's get you the best medical treatment we possibly can. You are not eligible for medical aid in dying, and that is clear. You can write in your medical directive who is going to be your decision maker once you no longer have decision-making capacity. And you can include in those directives things like, if I get pneumonia, I don't want to treat it. So you're not prolonging someone's life with dementia. If I am not asking for food and drink, don't force it on me. You can have all sorts of things that you write in there for your decision-makers to enforce for you. And that's highly effective. And you can decide that you don't want to prolong your life by usual medical treatments if you have end stage dementia. And then you have to have a durable power of attorney, somebody who makes those decisions for you, who you trust, and all the rest of that. It doesn't apply to medical aid in dying, full stop.
Okay. I had a conversation with my own doctor. I have a pacemaker. And I said to him, you know, we have ways of extending our life, and it might be artificial in some ways. Like I probably can't die of a heart attack possibly because of my pacemaker, which would be a kind of natural way of dying. So I guess we could write into our medical directive at some point, turn off any electronic devices that are prolonging my life. Is that a possibility?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. People with pacemakers still die. You can die of a heart attack. Your pacemaker can still function, but your heart will not be functioning. So you'll still die. You can take that as you will. But we do
have
some...
Well, actually, that's comforting to me.
Sure. Yeah. That's why I said... In whose language. The interesting thing in some of the real advances or you know, somebody might argue the opposite, is that patients have the right to refuse medical care even if it brings on their death. So you could tomorrow say that you want to turn off your pacemaker. And we would be obliged by all ethical criteria to allow you to do that. I might fight you on it and say, hey, you've got a great radio show. We don't want you to die. And here, look how successful you're being and how fruitful your life is. I might fight you on it. But as I say to all my patients, if I disagree with you and we have a disagreement, you win. And so if you came to me and said, I want to turn off my pacemaker, and I looked at the reasons for why you have the pacemaker and found out that you would die. Some people turn off a pacemaker, they just get weak. So we have to really investigate it. But we have had cases where people have asked to turn off their pacemaker because they no longer want advanced medical care. And they've done that, and they have entered into a terminal illness, and we have helped them die. So it's interesting. There are a lot of subtleties in this business. We have an ethics consultation service at the Academy that looks into all of these subtleties. We have very experienced discussions about this. We have a Journal of Aid in Dying Medicine, which is now 2 years old. And so these are the things that come up in our business that are complicated. And it's not simple, as you said. But we have thoughts about this. We have things that are sometimes unsettled. But certainly with pacemakers, there have been multiple cases where people have withdrawn from treatment. Same thing for ventilators, right? Same thing to decide you don't want to treat a pneumonia. Same thing to decide you want to stop your chemotherapy, right? You have the right to stop your chemotherapy, even if your oncologist says, oh, but I'll make you live 6 months longer if you continue. And you say, no, but I'm miserable on it. You can stop it. And so we deal with those circumstances all the time. Your pacemaker does not save your life, except at the moment.
Thanks. So what are the services that are offered by the Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine?
Oh, first of all, our main mission is to teach clinicians. So along that mission, we can't teach them unless we know what we're talking about. So we do a lot of research, investigation, we advance the level of the types of medications, we collect massive amounts of data, and then we have conferences, and we teach, and we have online teaching platforms, and fundamentally, we are a clinically based organization who teaches about medical aid in dying to clinicians who will be out in the field working with patients. We also have a very extensive patient-to-doctor referral system so that when patients are not able to find clinicians who are experienced and who can help them with a medical aid in dying consideration, they can contact the Academy. If they go to our website, the Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine, they can find a patient portal where they enter into that, and there's a patient referral system. And we will find them, and we have 100% success rate. We will find them an experienced clinician who we trust, who will help them with their aid in dying, finding a clinician. At that point in time, we know that it's an experienced clinician. We're not involved in the patient's care. We don't do direct patient care, mm-hmm. but we will do referrals. Fundamentally, we run conferences, we teach, we have a journal, we have online teaching, we do investigations. The medications that are used now were innovated by the Academy. So there's a lot that we do. We're busy folks.
Well, for sure. Would you advocate that this is added to the curriculum of training doctors?
Yes, it depends on the level. I have to say that we should have all clinicians Not only doctors, but everything from doulas to doctors. All people who work with patients should know about medical aid in dying, because the patients aren't going to say, I'm going to come to the aid in dying doctor. They will first talk about it with their, you know, their end-of-life doula, or they might talk about it with their primary care doctor or with their nurse practitioner or their oncologist. All those people need some baseline knowledge. They don't all have to be skilled in aid in dying medicine. As I said, it's rare. It's not a common practice. We don't want somebody who's going to do this once every 10 years, honestly, doing it. Right. So if your family practitioner is going to do one aid in dying death every 10 years, they're not going to be good at it. We want to train the people who will do more.
Oh, I just want to thank you so much for being with us today. I've been speaking with Dr. Lonnie Shavelson. He is the author of A Chosen Death and Medical Aid in Dying, A Guide for Patients and Their Supporters. And if you want to be in touch with his work, you can go to the website aadm.org, which stands for Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine. That's aadm.org. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org, where you'll find more than 2,000 programs in its archive. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I want to thank you. I invite you, please, to join us again. This is program number 3,855.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You, too, can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the Donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. American robins begin piping up in late winter and then sing all through spring and summer, sometimes well into fall, too. One way to remember their song's pattern is with the words cheerily, cheer up, cheer up, cheerily, cheer up. The Baltimore Oriole has a pretty similar song. At first, you might think there's no way to tell these two cheery, upbeat singers apart. But there are a couple of differences. The robin has that whole sentence to say, cheerily, cheer up, cheer up, cheerily, cheer up. In contrast, the oriole usually stops after a phrase or two. After a while, you might start to hear more subtle distinctions. Baltimore orioles sound sweeter, more melodic than American robins, who can come across a little screechy at times. Once more, here's the long-winded robin. and the short and sweet Oriole. Listen for these sweet singers wherever you get your bird song. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.